Officials at the Department of Natural Resources announced a new initiative today aimed at stamping out a dangerous increase in lupine obesity. The plan involves breeding special sheep, which are every bit as appealing to wolves as ordinary sheep, but are low in calories and bad cholesterol. DNR Representative Bill Greeley.
Successful deployment of these new sheep can rid the wolves of their gigantic fat asses. Provided the wolves don't overdo the sauces or butter, of course.
An earlier experimental sheep-soybean hybrid was abandoned after it produced an animal possessing neither wool nor flavor, rendering it entirely useless to wolves and farmers alike.
Hey, everybody, what's happening? Yeah, get some. Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. Kind of like My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult, except with food. Hey, listen, I got to tell you guys, I'm not sure why there was so much backlash to the Jamie Oliver thing last episode. I know he can camp it up a bit on that show, and there has to be a certain amount of drama in that show, you know? I mean, it's on prime time. ABC on a Friday, and they sold that show with the understanding that there's going to be a certain amount of drama there, and that's okay, but you've got to look at the big picture here. To not look at the big picture and what he's doing and why he's doing it is kind of short-sighted, and we've got to think about just how important this really is. I mean, 4 years ago, would a show like this be on primetime television? No. Hell no. And I like that Jamie's doing this, that he's taking the time to do it and bringing it to American television. Here's Jamie with CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta.
Can anyone cook?
Anyone can cook. Historically, it was a more of a kind of, not sexist, but the girls went off to the cooking and the boys went off to metal work and woodwork. But look, I mean, for me, I just feel right now in this environment, but this is one of America's dark moments in health. Especially with children, you know, they say that this is the first generation of kids expected to live a shorter lifespan than their own parents. And yet, you know, in schools we really need them to have nourishing food, cooked on site, local if at all possible, and also be taught to cook 10 recipes to save their life.
People talk about childhood obesity a lot. You know, President Clinton's looked into this, obviously. A lot of organizations have tried to address this. And I got to tell you, you know, even here at CNN, we really have taken this on as well. It seems tough. It seems tough because people don't want to listen. They all know a lot of the stuff that you're saying. How first of all, why do you think you're going to get through, and how do you do it?
I think being a foreigner in this country, having a totally clear, unbiased opinion of anything, you know, you can kind of walk into a situation and sort of evaluate it. And what I'm getting from people is they do want help. They just want quick, easy tools, and they want to be shown very clearly how to do it.
Well, that's a perfect segue. So you called yourself an outsider, coming to the United States, looking in. Again, if people want to do the right thing, they want to do right by their own bodies, their children's bodies, who is wearing the black hat in all this? Is it the food industry, fast food? I mean, I know everyone says, look, everyone's to blame, but you...
I've changed my views. 5 years ago, I would have given you a long old list of people that I'd love to slap about, right, and disappear off of the face of the earth. And that would be a very immature sort of way to deal with the black hat guys. These brands, these logos are loved, you know. And, I, you know, so my grown-up attitude has gone from being much more activist to, well, you can activist and burn things down all you like. They ain't going nowhere. Mm. So really, I believe that everyone's part of the solution.
Tell me where we can see the program.
The show is on Friday nights, 9 o'clock. It's an hour long. There's 6 of them. And all I would say is... Look, you know, life's to have fun and all that stuff, yeah? But I believe this show is not a spectator sport. You know, if you are moved by this story, then get on jamiesfoodrevolution.com. It'll take 30 seconds to sign a petition that supports what I'm trying to do and take it to Capitol Hill to support the First Lady, to get those strange people that are going to try and stop her do her job, you know, put in place. And really, in your own lives as parents, talk to other parents. Talk to your principal. Don't just believe a bit of paper that has a menu on it, because paper can look good. Go and watch it. We shouldn't have to worry about it, but we mustn't presume that everything's okay, because it ain't.
And it's amazing how much of an impact it'll make on this generation, future generations, healthcare as well. It'll cut down on a lot of those costs we've been talking so much about.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
Rick Sellers from Pacific Brew News and Odonata Beer. He sent this to me, and it's a post on this blog, Don't Eat the Shrimp. And it ties right into this discussion. Turns out a school district prefers that you eat their pizza instead of bringing lunch from home, right here upstate in California. And it's pertinent on a lot of levels here, because there are people who think that the government should function like a business. And the author of the particular post, he makes a good point. Businesses are in business to make money. And when it comes to feeding school kids, it's kind of a conflict of interest. Turns out the Chico Unified School District is rolling out a new pizza product at Chico's high schools and their junior high schools. And the money that's being used for this isn't local money. It's from a $110,000 federal stimulus grant. And that's not what irritates the blogger who wrote this post. What's irritating him is a quote from the Director of Nutrition Services. She said their biggest competition is coming from a really tough source, the mothers of children who pack their lunch. Quotes, I'm competing with mom, actually, pointing out that anything a parent can do to put into their lunch bag is in direct competition with the hot lunch operation. So in essence, the Chico Unified School District would prefer that you buy their frozen crap pizza instead of bringing a healthy lunch from home. Nutrition Services is a self-sustaining operation that takes no money out of the district's general funds. It works on federal funding and food sales. And while the enrollment in the CUSD has been sliding in recent years, the number of meals served has steadily climbed, which brings the discussion back to pizza. And the author of the post makes a really good point here. If the school district is providing meals, why wouldn't the money come out of the district? Because when it doesn't, this is what happens. You get things like this, where the organization does whatever it can to make money. And this is a really good example of what's wrong with the school lunch program in our country. Everything is being run like a business at any cost. It's okay if you want to run certain things like a business because you have to. But when it comes to kids, I don't think it's a good idea. Because businesses will cut corners like crazy to increase their bottom line. If you know anything about business, when it comes to those profitability reports that you run every month, you look at that bottom line and you want what you're looking at down there to be as big as possible, okay? Size does matter. And that's just business. It really is. However, I think when you're talking about feeding kids in school, you've got to think differently. And if mom wants Johnny to be healthy, and so she packs him a sandwich from home or some other homemade soup or some salad or whatever, I think it's her prerogative. That's her child. And the school's bottom line has absolutely nothing to do with that. So, Rick, thanks for the article, man. It was dead on, and I know we talked about this a lot last episode, and I don't want to beat a dead horse again. You know, some of you didn't care for Jimmy Oliver, and that's fine. And it was just overall. I mean, the web was kind of a hotbed of talk when it came to this. Anyway, that story I just read kind of ties right into our beer this week. I think Rick Sellers, Pacific Brew News, I think of Chico, and then I think of Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. And Sierra Nevada just so happens to make one hell of a great Bavarian-style Hefeweizen. It's called Kellerweiz. And it's available in six packs for the same price that you would pay for any of their other beers, except of Bigfoot, I think, is a lot more expensive. But it's great. I got it for, I think, $7 for a six-pack. And what I like about this Hefeweizen is that it is a true Bavarian-style Hefeweizen. And please say it right. Gonzo on Dude Night gave us a whole show's worth of material on this way back in the day, and it's Hefeweizen. Hefeweizen. My friend Frank slaughters this word like nobody else, and I know he's not alone. He calls it Hefeweizen. Hefeweizen. There's no N in there. Then I hear Hefeweizen, Hefeweizen. Dude, please. Hefeweizen. In Germany, when you drink any Hefeweizen, you can expect to taste something relatively close to other Hefeweizens. But for some reason, in this country, craft breweries out there in the U.S. seem to think Hefeweizen just means wheat beer. that the style is open to interpretation. And if you ask me, it's not. To them, Hefeweizen, as long as it's made with wheat, can taste however they want it to. They'll use ale yeast, just some standard ale yeast, and the yeast you should be using to produce this authentic Hefeweizen is from Feinstefaner, and it's a university in Germany where it was actually created, where it came from. And I think that's debatable. Anyway, traditional Bavarian Hefeweizen should taste like cloves, bubblegum, bananas, should have those characteristics to it. But if you drink Widmer Hefeweizen, for instance, it tastes like American wheat beer, which is not bad, but it's not what I would consider Hefeweizen. And you get none of the qualities that you find in traditional Bavarian beer. Kellerweiss tastes traditionally Bavarian, and it's one of the only American Hefeweizens that's made using this traditional Bavarian style of open fermentation. That means it's got a wide open vat, right? So the beer's out in the open. It's left wide open. The yeast can just jump in there and do its thing. It's very labor-intensive for the brewery. It adds a little extra work, so it costs them more to make it. But it adds really, really great deep, deep flavor that you're not going to get otherwise. I'm having it right now. It's fantastic. It's definitely one of these beers that I love during the spring and summer, so it's perfect for those warmer days. And it's lots of tanginess to this beer. It's not too boozy. It's just south of 5%. They use pearl hops for this beer, and I read somewhere that they've been known to use Sterling sometimes too. Traditional pale malt, malted wheat, Munich malt, that's it. And that's what I put in my Hefeweizen. That's what BJ's Brewery used to make theirs when I brewed with them that day. That's just how it's done. And for Christ's sake, keep lemon out the glass, all right? No lemons, no oranges. Just drink the damn beer, hold the fruit.
At Blue Ridge Restaurant in D.C., Chef Barton Seaver is always busy cooking on one simple thing: how to make the menu more sustainable, especially when it comes to seafood.
And the ocean's in a very dilapidated and on a very dangerous precipice right now. And we've simply eaten too many fish out of the ocean. And make no mistake, we've eaten them. They haven't just disappeared.
He's right. International studies show startling declines in sea life in at least much of the ocean, especially among keystone species like giant tuna, swordfish, and salmon. Despite the increase in farmed fishing, some scientists predict at this rate, the world's wild fisheries will be largely depleted in 50 years. So what to do about it? For Barton, that's easy.
So it really begins with your choice of ingredients.
Absolutely.
He's on the cutting edge of the movement to focus on more vegetables and smaller, plentiful seafood species.
I like this dish because it allows me to use anchovies. Anchovies are one of my very favorite fish.
Anchovies. Little tiny anchovies.
Yeah, these little fillets of oil-packed anchovies. They're fantastic, and they're relatively cheap.
And there are a lot of anchovies in the world.
Yeah.
Well, anchovies, sardines, mackerels, clams, catfish, oysters. These are the seafoods he likes.
Okay, so what is this?
We've got some farm-raised mussels.
And his customers seem to like them too. Good thing, because he believes the traditional way of eating those keystone species is sinking fast.
You flat out believe that if we keep going the way we are, that we will use up these resources?
Absolutely. We are on that path.
So, back at the restaurant, diners can pick up an easy pocket guide to sustainable fishes, and the menu is filled with such choices, and simply by providing tasty alternatives, no one complains.
The problem with our oceans is not a matter of the environment, it's a matter of our behavior. And if we shift our behavior, if we change what we eat, then we've got a shot.
And this is all doable.
This is all beyond doable, it's all delicious.
One simple idea, one bite at a time. Tom Foreman, CNN, Washington.
I'll tell you something. My mixer is doing something funny. Either my mixer or my microphone. I'm hearing some crackling, but I'm playing it back and I'm not hearing that. So, only 58 episodes and my stuff's breaking down already? I'm not even treating it bad. When I was in bands and stuff, we used to stay up late at night. We'd spill beer on a mixer and just mistreat stuff. And it still worked, well, for the most part. Anyway, so Soul Train. I'm sure you're wondering what the hell that's about. It's about this really interesting night in Los Angeles that Katrina and I had that naturally would involve Peter and Joe, because anytime something exciting happens lately in regards to food, they're involved. But we didn't plan on it involving them. It just happened to, you know, work out that way. And I'm never going to say no to seeing them anytime, anyplace. Katrina gets this Facebook friend request from Debbie Lee. And she says, hey, check this out. Turns out Debbie Lee, who was on last year's Food Network Star Series, was doing a run at the Bread Bar in Los Angeles, where we ate Little Bites for the first time. And if you don't remember, Debbie Lee cooked a lot of great Korean dishes on the Next Food Network Star, this past run of Next Food Network Star. And she even threw in some Southern feel to some of her dishes, and it made them really soulful. And this stint that she's doing at the Bread Bar is basically a warm-up to her opening her restaurant later this year in Los Angeles. The concept of her food is soul food, tapas style. And soul is spelled Seoul, like the city of Seoul in Korea, South Korea. And when we got to the restaurant, she explained even further that it was like pub grub. That's what she was getting at. Kind of like an izakaya in Japan. You basically eat small bites, tapas, right? And, you know, you eat this food while you're blowing your brains out with alcohol. My kind of meal. Well, I don't really think I knew what to expect because I didn't really know her food all that well. And that's a good thing because her food blew me away. First thing that came to the table was her house-made kimchi. And it was absolutely fantastic. Not too hot, just spicy enough. She made both daikon and Napa cabbage kimchi. Just spiced enough, but crispy vegetables still took the center stage there. And let me say up front that I'm not usually this forward with chefs, but Debbie is so friendly and so sweet that when we left, I had to hug her. She was just huggable. Just a really sweet, nice person. I'm a hugger anyway. All right, I hug my friends. I don't care what people think. If I really like you, you can pretty much prepare for the hug. But what makes her so likable is that she's friendly. She comes out, she introduces herself. She's out in the back busting her ass, right? But she comes out to her customers and introduces herself, smiles the entire time, not stressed out. It's dinner service on a Saturday, mind you. Not stressed out at all. Brings plates to the table, explains everything on the menu to us in great detail. This is a sign of a chef with complete confidence. No stressing out. She's got it under control, and it makes it hard not to like her. Anyway, so the kimchi comes, and that's just going to sit on the table, and we're chewing on that. Chips and dip was the first thing that came. It was some curry mountain bean hummus with wonton crostini. This isn't your friend's Super Bowl chips and dip. It's a curry bean hummus that has tastes of bean paste with a very light curry flavor mixed into it. Nice and light. Like almost everything that came to the table that night, I could have eaten it all night long for the most part. And the wontons, acting as chips, was just a brilliant idea. Next, she brings out these Korean rice cylinders that are wrapped in maple smoked bacon and then served with a jalapeno ponzu. This is what you see in the lead image on the blog. It's kind of like off to the center, kind of artsy. MyLifeIsFoodie.com, check it out. These were my favorite things of the night, really. They're these little rice cake cylinders that are super soft, and they're wrapped in some of the best sweet smoky bacon I've ever tasted. Put my bacon to shame, totally. In this dipping sauce. And I know it was against protocol, but I wanted to taste them separately. I ate the skewer, and then I took a sip of the sauce. Bad form, Philly. Yeah, but I did it. I wanted to taste everything individually. Oh, man. Again, something I probably could have eaten 20 of. I'd pound those things like free beer, man. Then she brings out this sesame flatbread with Perea pesto, soy-braised pork, and chili tomatoes. This is basically like a little flat Korean pizza with pesto on it. But the Perea pesto is different because it has pureed ketneep, I think that's how you pronounce it. It's a type of a leaf that's blended with oil. And then there's pieces of braised pork shoulder, and I'm guessing some tomatoes. With sweet pork and tomatoes, it's just, oh man. I love when chefs like Debbie turn pesto into something new that you hadn't tasted before. You know, you think of pesto, and then you think, basil. But I've had cilantro pesto with walnuts. Brilliant. And this is a flavor I'd not experienced before. So again, you could make pesto anyway. And I love surprises. So then out comes this dish that completely floors me. It's a dish that had soul and that I think sums up exactly what she's trying to do. It's Korean and it's Southern all at once. She called them Korean nachos, and they're fried rice cakes, those little cylinders, except this time they're fried, and they're covered in a smoky chili cheese sauce, real runny and melty, like runny Velveeta, but, you know, tastier, because real cheese. It had shredded pork and topped with a kimchi salsa. Just a genius dish. You bite into one of these tasty rice cake cylinders, deep fried, it's got a little cheese on it. It's just really comforting. It's like eating a hug. The cheese sauce, incredible. It's deep. Reminds me of how I feel when you have a dish like Ludo's braised oxtails and polenta with jus. Remember that dish? I talked about that. That dish had soul. It meant something. It tasted like there was a story behind it. And if you can make a dish that tastes like there's some history, that you're trying to say something by making it, to me, that's a successful dish. And that's how I felt when we had these nachos. And I put quotes on the word nachos because we're talking pub grub. This is fancy pub grub. So after this, I'm thinking I'm going to hit the wall, right? But we had another dish coming. And you know me, if I think Korean, I think bulgogi. And we had to order that. She had it there, and I said, I got to taste it. Hers was bang on perfect, just how I like it. Thinly sliced beef, easy, just chew right through it. It's not chewy, just cuts right through. Marinated to perfection, grilled, served with grilled onions and a grilled Korean pepper that didn't have any heat to it, but it tasted really good. And it was served traditionally on pieces of lettuce, kind of like a wrap. You know, you put the meat inside the lettuce, wrap it up, and you eat it. So she's hit every dish out of the park, and I'm completely done. But of course, we've got to order dessert. So I'm not thinking dessert. I'm always thinking, you know, hit the exit. But here comes Chef Debbie's Fuji apple egg rolls that are served with a ginger mascarpone cream. And you want to know what these tasted like? Imagine a cannoli stuffed with apple pie filling. And that's pretty close to what these tasted like. They were fucking incredible. Whoops. Sorry about that. F-bomb alert. Ooh, earmuffs. See, this is why I can't be a food critic. Unreal. Yeah, cannoli meets apple pie. That's what these tasted like. All right, so now we're done with dinner. We're thanking her, paying the bill. Meanwhile, during dinner, I'm getting texts from Joe while we're eating. I said, hey, we're at the bread bar. She goes, no way. What are you doing at the bread bar? She said, we're at the bazaar having a drink. Come down. I said, well, as soon as we finish dinner, we'll come over to the SLS and we'll see you. Well, as dinner goes on, she's saying, we're going to Da Vinci's for dinner. Meet us there instead, right down the street. So we're heading out of Chef Debbie's Lee's Soul Town Tapas. We drive right down the street, literally down the street, about five blocks. We're at Da Vinci's Beverly Hills, park the car. What happens next kind of blew my mind a little bit. It was if we'd taken a train from one soulful restaurant to another soulful restaurant. And I'm about to meet a chef who reached out to me on Twitter, Chef Jason Fulilove. And he tweeted me a couple of weeks before asking me if we'd like to come down and taste their spring tasting menu. And I planned on getting down there, but it's LA, it's kind of far. We don't know when we're going to do it. And I don't want to give him a definite yes until I was sure we could come down. Well, it was about to happen because Joe had already planned this. I had no idea that this was coming. Had I known, I'd have gone a little light at Soultown Tapas. But Joe was on it already. When we got there, they were already enjoying a foie gras terrine and a white asparagus soup, I think it was. And listen, I thought they were ordering dinner, okay? I was just going to say hello. We brought her some dessert from Debbie's place. And I had no idea what was going down until much later. So we get there, and Joe's sitting with Chef Fulilove. And he looked familiar. When I met this guy, he's a big dude, big voice, big thick dreadlocks, good-looking guy. Looks like he could be on television. And I thought maybe I'd seen him somewhere. Well, turns out Joe tells me he was the chef de cuisine for Elin Hall, who won Top Chef Season 2. And the restaurant was called The Gorbals. I'd never heard of that before. Joe seems to know all this stuff. You know, she's filling me in on everything. Now, I've never tasted anything from The Gorbals. Never even heard of it. Because as I said, you know, prior to last year, we hardly experienced new restaurants. So I didn't really know what to expect from Chef Fulilove. Well, he starts laying down plates like crazy, and we start sampling his stuff. There was this plate of fried artichokes that were outstanding, served with garlic and lemons. They were like deep-fried artichoke chips, but it was hard. You know, they're little artichoke hearts, so we're stuffing the whole thing in your mouth at once. Oh, man alive. Then he brought out a heirloom beet salad that had radishes, Humboldt Fog, my favorite, and it was topped with a pistachio vinaigrette. When I found out from Joe, who got a hold of the menu, that it was Humboldt Fogg in that salad. I knew this guy didn't screw around with his ingredients. You know how I feel about Humboldt Fogg. He knows what's good, and he'll go out of his way to source the really good stuff. He brought a plate of asparagus ravioli that was served with a pecorino romano and cherry tomatoes. I didn't taste this dish, but it looked like a perfect springtime dish to me and a vegetarian option. Now, if there's one smart thing that a chef like Jason will do, is that he'll create vegetarian options that you don't realize are vegetarian. And it's good to think this way, especially if you throw a lot of dinner parties. You're always going to have or run into the situation where somebody wants a vegetarian option. And something as simple as asparagus ravioli done just right will hit a home run because they're going to love it, and it's not going to taste like it was vegetarian. Another thing that I didn't taste but Joe had was squid ink linguine. And she wrote about this on her blog, mylastbite.com. She said it was earthy. Now, later our server, Alina, came out and she told us that the chef loved to experiment with squid. Well, when you're playing around with squid ink, I think it's quite apparent that you like to play around with squid. Obviously, he plays around a lot because he brought out some evil genius thing, squid ink chips. Now, listen to this. He takes squid ink, mixes it with something that binds it. I didn't catch what it was. Maybe it was like alginate or something. I don't know. He lays it out on a sheet of acetate and then dehydrates it. Then he peels off the acetate, cuts it out in circles, and deep fries them. Dude, best thing ever. It's like the most labor-intensive gourmet chip you'll ever put in your mouth. I could eat those all night. So now I'm starting to realize that Chef plays around with molecular gastronomy because he brought out an amuse-bouche of preserved lemon ricotta with poached figs. Oh, man. And a pistachio dust and a sage foam inside the little spoon. And I thought, here's a chef who uses molecular gastronomy techniques in absolute moderation, wisely, all right? Not in your face. And he said later, he goes, he didn't want people coming to expect molecular gastronomy. He does not want to be known as that kind of a chef. But do know that it's a tool in his arsenal that he'll use from time to time when a dish that he's trying to create needs it. And I think that's what is great about molecular gastronomy and why we should never, you know, look at the end of that. There were more dishes. Red snapper with lobster vinaigrette. Octopus sausage. Dude makes his own octopus sausage. It was like the murkiest, earthiest seafood sausage you'll ever taste. Except that it's all octopus, and it wasn't dry. I'm not sure what he used for fat in that sausage. Because, you know, otherwise you can have a really dry sausage if you don't use fat. I don't think there's any fat in octopus. He brought out a plate of Colorado lamb sickles, served with a side of his own house-cured lamb bacon. Lamb bacon. Well, where have you ever had lamb bacon? Lamb and bacon are not two words you usually see together. Heirloom carrots were on that plate, I think. I mean, he's sourcing ingredients from all over the place like crazy. And now the food's coming out blistering pace. We can't finish something. There's another plate coming down. He laid down something on our table that became my instant favorite. Halibut ceviche. It was like I was eating an entire plate of pickled herring from Sweden. Fresh, tangy, delicious. It had just a light touch of lemon, capers, onions, and the fish was perfectly done. I have told you time and time again on this show that I love ceviche on it's just one of the best things ever. I've got like an infatuation with ceviche. But nobody at the table wanted anything to do with this. Probably because it hit the wall. But there was no way I was letting this dish go to waste. I ate the entire plate of fish. My compliments to the chef, man. I'd go back just for that one dish. Of course, we're not going to get out of there yet because there's dessert now. You know, we've got to have dessert. So Joe ran the whole thing down on her website. There are pictures, too, if you want to see what the stuff looks like. MyLastBite.com. Strawberry rhubarb sorbet, kiwi sorbet, apple zeppoli with blueberry cream sauce, a Meyer lemon panna cotta with butter cookie crumbs. Oh, dude, just nuts. I mean, I am done. I felt like I've been hit by a gourmet truck. I was startling the number of plates this man conjured up with precision and didn't even have a full staff in the back. An amazing amount of work going into these plates and an unbelievable number of ingredients. Oh, and he's talkative, right? Comes out constantly, ready to explain how he does certain things, how he prepares it, loves to talk about his process, loves to talk about sourcing ingredients. I said, how do you find time in the day for sleep? He goes, man, I've been doing this forever. I think he could do it in his sleep. Actually, I think he comes up with some of this stuff in his sleep. And this is why I say, please understand what kind of work effort, and personal sacrifice that chefs make in order to give you a good time on a Friday night, Saturday night, whenever. They bust their ass all day, every day, to make sure you have a meal that you'll remember. And sometimes they're going to miss, but you're just going to have to understand that, you know, maybe the 90% of the time they hit hard. And that 10%, you can forgive them. You don't boo a guy for batting. If a guy's batting 400, you don't boo him if he strikes out, do you? You guys that are batting over 300 don't get booed if they strike out. So why would you boo a guy who's hitting 900, right? When you read bullshit reviews on Yelp or whatever half-assed restaurant review site that you visit, please note, hardworking chefs like Jason Fully Love, Debbie Lee, are putting themselves on the line to make your evening special every day. And when you read a review where some idiot says he'd been better off going to Applebee's, you got to put that into perspective. I wouldn't know how to make that comparison, all right? I like my food in season, thought out, made with care and love. And with a last name like Fully Love, how can you possibly miss, right? Da Vinci Restaurant, DaVinci'sBeverlyHills.com. They're located at 9737 Santa Monica Boulevard in Beverly Hills. Phone number is 310-888-0090. Their spring tasting menu is prefixed, 5 courses, $50. You can do a wine pairing with that, $80. Open now through May 30th. They also have a happy hour every day, 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. They got really good drinks in there, too. And follow Debbie Lee on Twitter at Soul2Soul. That's Soul, the city, S-E-O-U-L, to Soul.
My grandparents use it, my mom uses it, and now I have it to use.
This kraut cutter has been in Teresa Klaus's family for generations.
We put the cabbage in there.
She and her son Caleb are making 100 pounds of sauerkraut for a 4-H project.
This is for the 4-H fair.
It's actually pretty fun to make it because you get a lot of hands-on while making it.
Last year, Caleb won a purple ribbon at the state fair for the recipe. But this year, the sauerkraut isn't winning over neighbors.
I think it's ridiculous.
Recently, the family got this letter from the owner of their mobile home park. It says they used poor judgment because of the smell and asks them to please stop cooking sauerkraut.
I was shocked. I told her that what I do in my house, nobody has a right to tell me what to do. And she was not happy with that.
The park owner tells us there have been 3 complaints about the smell. In her view, it's just a matter of being considerate of your neighbors.
The sauerkraut has to ferment for days. The whole process lasts about 2 weeks. Even so, Teresa says you cannot smell it outside her home.
Oh, my God. I'm like, yeah, it does smell. It has a really strong odor to it. But, I mean, we're in a confined room, and outside the room, you couldn't smell it.
She says the family will continue to make sauerkraut for the 4-H project. She may even offer some to her neighbors, but has a feeling they probably won't take it.
When I saw that story, I just started laughing. Just ridiculous on every level. If you go to CNN.com and on the video, go to the video section, do a search on stinky food, and that should come up. I mean, look at that mobile home park. Looks like a dump. I had to wonder, who the hell would be complaining about the smell of sauerkraut when you live in a rundown mobile home park? And listen, you don't live out in the country with 15 acres to do stuff like this on. I mean, imagine if someone was making kimchi out there. If you're cooking 100 pounds of cabbage in your house, there's no way that smell isn't seeping out somehow. You've been locked up in that mobile home all day boiling cabbage, and you go outside, you say, I can't smell it out here. That's only because you're not right on top of it. It still smells out there, but I think it's funny that they're making such a big deal out of it. That's like spending the day walking through a pool of dog turds. Right? And then you go to a neighbor's house and you go, hey, it smells great in here. Yeah, it smells great to you, but you smell like dog turds, man. Now get the fuck out, turd boy. Hey, this is pretty funny. This was sent to me by Monkeybone on Twitter. An Australian publisher is reprinting 7,000 cookbooks over a recipe for pasta with salt and freshly ground black people. Penguin Group Australia's head of publishing, Bob Sessions, acknowledged the proofreader should have caught the silly mistake. He told the Sydney Morning Herald for a story printed Saturday that we're mortified that this has become an issue of any kind and why anyone would be offended, we don't know. The typo was in the pasta Bible, a recipe for spelt tagliatelle with sardines and prosciutto. Sessions said the publisher would replace the book for any buyer small-minded enough to complain. The reprinting will cost $20,000 Australian dollars. There's no way on earth that was a typo. I mean, misspelling the, T-E-H, that's a typo. Or spelling a word the way it sounds instead of how it's supposed to be spelled, that's a typo. But black people instead of black pepper, that's intentional. And it's shameful. I mean, look, we may have a black man leading the most powerful nation in the world, and even that's debatable. But it's not thwarting racism. This is just messed up. And we need to grow up, crown black people. Whoa. Here's one last thing I want to share with you guys, then I'll let you go. ABC News ran this special report on, of all things, the Twinkie. It turns out this dude deconstructs the Twinkie, right? And he wrote an entire book on it. A little geeky, but it reminded me of what made Food Tech with Bobby Bogner so great. It gets right down to the essence of what goes into something that people eat all the time. They've been eating it for years. But, you know, what resonated in my head was that quote, that voiceover quote at the beginning of Food Inc., the guy says, if you knew what was really in the food that you're eating every day, you might not want to eat it.
The true all-American dessert is the Twinkie. What it lacks in dignity, it makes up for in taste, of course, and in history. It has been around for 77 years. It lasts that long. Just kidding. But what exactly is in a Twinkie? Well, ABC's John Berman answers that burning question for us.
When most people look at a Twinkie, they see a small yellow cake, 4 inches long, with cream inside. They see a moist, delicious dessert. But when food writer Steve Ettlinger looks at a Twinkie, he sees something more.
I see the mastery of the problems of shelf life, of distribution, of making something in a large quantity while keeping it sanitary, while keeping it uniform.
When I look at a Twinkie, I think golden creamy goodness.
I joked perhaps because I didn't know just what was behind that golden creamy goodness.
How many ingredients are in a Twinkie?
39. 39. Now that's counting the vitamins and minerals in the fortified flour.
Ettlinger knows because he did something a little astounding and a little geeky. He wrote an entire book on the Twinkie, 283 pages. He spent 5 years as a food detective, traveling the country to track down the source of all 39 ingredients. Hostess didn't exactly cooperate.
Even though I didn't reveal any secret, certainly no trade secrets, and definitely I didn't reveal anything shockingly bad.
Hostess turns out 500 million Twinkies every year. 500 million. Each one is made from flour, sugar, corn syrup, things you might expect. And then there are a whole lot of things you might never expect, unless you normally eat glue and rocket fuel. For instance, there is corn dextrin.
It's a great glue. It's the glue you find on the back of envelopes that you lick. It stays dry. When it's dry, it's not so sticky. When it's wet, it sticks right together.
How could you have one and not eat one?
And there is cellulose gum. In the Twinkie, it gives the cream the smooth feel.
It's in a lot of low-fat salad dressings, ice creams, and it's used in rocket fuel to give a slightly gelatinous feel to the rocket fuel. I just love that.
Rocket fuel? It's a strange kind of fun.
And fun is having a Hostess Twinkie. Light.
When Ettlinger laid out a bunch of the ingredients in the Twinkie, it didn't look much like a magical flying Twinkie romp, nor did it look much like a bakery.
It looks like a chemistry set.
It is. It's like a chemistry set. And I have to tell you, I really enjoyed coming through the airport security with these big rocks.
That's right, rocks. At least 5 rocks go into making a Twinkie. There is trona in the baking soda, limestone in the baking powder, and of course, salt.
Is there anything wrong with the fact that Twinkies have 39 ingredients and are made from rocks and use petroleum?
No, because if there were, there'd be something wrong with all our processed foods. Now, some people don't like that, in which case they can eat more whole foods, fruits, vegetables, and what have you.
I have all real, what I call whole foods, whole grain flours that are unbleached.
We found a woman who makes a vegan Twinkie. It tastes okay, but comes at a cost.
Now, we talk about shelf life. The shelf life will be much shorter. But
there, she said it. The magic words that make the Twinkie world and the world of all processed foods go round. Shelf life.
In order to get shelf life, you give up something. Fresh eggs, fresh cream, fresh butter. So you need to not only extend the shelf life of the product you're making, but you have to replace those eggs with emulsifiers. You have to replace the butter with flavors.
Twinkies have a legendary shelf life. They're rumored to last longer than their plastic wrappers. That isn't true, but they still can last about a month.
The Twinkie people have managed to keep the filling just so it doesn't get absorbed into the cake. That's a big challenge for a baker.
Hostess had a somewhat metaphysical take on Steve's book. Deconstructing the Twinkie is like trying to deconstruct the universe. Some people look at the sky and think it's beautiful. Others try to count the stars. We think the millions of people who have made Twinkies one of the most popular snacks in American history would agree that Twinkies just taste great.
What's got me puzzled, how can anybody wrap their arms around the words processed food as if it were a good thing? He goes, look, this is what makes processed food great. Now, some people might not like that, but for them, there are whole foods, fruits and vegetables, but we like this. Okay, dude. Have at it. Hey, we think what fans of Twinkies think, that it just tastes great. Hey, you know what else is great? Crack cocaine and heroin. Holy shit, the way heroin makes you feel, unbelievable. I've read that the reason why heroin is so addictive right off the bat is because when you have it for the first time, they say it's like having a 30-minute long orgasm. Who's going to say no to a 30-minute long orgasm? Well, if you realize how addictive and bad for your body heroin is, maybe you should just deal with that 8-second all-natural one. That's all I'm saying. If I'm going to illustrate it, that's how I do it. Natural or processed. Okay, I'm out of here. Thanks for tuning in. How the hell did... I was talking to Twinkies and I end up talking about orgasm. This show is brutal. If you're in the LA area, check out Chef Fooley Love's incredible menu at Da Vinci. Visit DaVinci'sBeverlyHills.com for information and reservation details. Also, keep your eyes peeled for Debbie Lee's new restaurant in Los Angeles later this year. I'll keep you guys up to date on that as details come streaming in. You really haven't tasted Korean food like this before, believe me. Special thanks to CNN, The Onion, and ABC for the audio clips. Music in this episode from Taras Tranquil. If you like the song, you can download it in the iTunes store or directly from the band's MySpace page, myspace.com/Taras Tranquil. Go to mylifeasafoodie.com for a direct link. You can buy the music. I've spelled everything out. A great band. I hope you guys can help me support them. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Cheers.